This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Although New Hampshire has a stated goal of adopting alternative energy, when it comes to wind power, projects have been slow to get up and spinning. Over the past decade, three wind facilities have been built here in Leominster, Groton, and near the town of Dummer. All have faced some pushback before approval was granted. But now another proposal for the state's largest wind farm to date is encountering perhaps the stiffest opposition yet. It's called the Wild Meadows Project, and it would be located in the tourism-dependent Newfound Lake region, specifically the towns of Alexandria, Danbury, and Grafton. The company behind it is the Spanish firm Iberdrola Renewables, which owns two of the three Granite State wind farms. The firm recently kicked off a series of local public meetings on the project and faced intense questioning from residents. People worried that pristine views would be ruined, that tourism would suffer, along with local property values, and that the turbines themselves would be noisy and kill birds. But there are many Granite Staters behind this project as well, who say it'll bring a brick chunk of clean, renewable power to our energy mix, and that if we're committed to a clean energy future, it may mean some local sacrifices. Today in The Exchange, a new turn in New Hampshire's wind power debate. Let's hear from you. Is adding more wind power a good move for our state? Or is this type of renewable energy not the right fit for New Hampshire? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. Keep those emails short. Or you can post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. We have three guests in studio, Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter, who's been following this story. And Sam, thanks for taking the time out for us today.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Lisa Lenoz, Executive Director of Industrial Wind Action Group, a national advocacy organization focused on issues associated with industrial wind energy development and renewable energy policy. And Lisa, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Ed Cherian, Regional Development Director for Iberdrola Renewables. That's the Spanish-owned company that I mentioned, which is also the second largest wind operator in the U.S. And Ed, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Good morning, Laura.
Ed, I'm going to start with you since this is your company's project. More broadly, though, what's the potential in terms of wind energy here in New Hampshire that Iberdrola sees? How good is our wind here? You know, you think the prairie states, fine. But New Hampshire, how good's our wind?
Well, I think the potential overall is fairly limited just by virtue of the state being a small state. But where there are wind resources, particularly on ridgelines, there are some exceptional areas that can be very efficient in producing electricity. We've built two projects in Leominster and Groton. There's not opportunities all over the state. And that's primarily because there's a series of limiting factors on what makes an appropriate wind power site, looking at environmental issues and access to transmission and things like that.
So the wind is the best on top of the ridges, on top of New Hampshire's mountaintops. That's where the resource is the strongest.
Yes, for the
makes
most part.
Sense. Yeah. And is that part of the problem, though, Ed, is that people see these things on top of mountains? They're very visible. It's too bad you can't tuck them in a valley or something.
Maybe that is part of the problem. Visibility is certainly a key issue on any wind project that's proposed in New Hampshire. And I think there's people that don't like the look of them. There are those that do like the look of them and see them as part of a green energy future. And I think a lot of people, particularly in towns that are nearby, just time to get used to it. Just like you have power lines or cell towers or ski trails and a number of other things that are part of the visual environment.
You know, I mentioned, Ed, that Iberdrola is the second largest wind operator in the U.S., so you must be operating in other states. Is there a different political climate in other states when it comes to wind power? Have other states been more accepting, or is it always kind of a process of selling this to folks, no matter where they are?
No, it varies widely, extremely widely. I've worked on projects in Texas, and there tends to be a very brief permitting process and widespread acceptance. But Texas is a different kind of state, and there's a lot of land of relatively low value. And so it's a different environment there. We also have projects in the Midwest and work with a lot of farmers where there's a broad acceptance of wind turbines and wind farms as a complementary use of land along with farming. And the state process is very widely as well. In general, in the Northeast, permitting processes tend to be more complicated and longer.
Well, and we'll talk about the process a little bit later. But Sam Evans-Brown, to you too, you've been looking at not just this latest project, but wind power overall. How does wind power, Sam, fit into the state's overall goal for renewable energy, this renewable portfolio standard that we're told about?
So right now, on the renewable portfolio standard, wind counts as it's a class one. And right now, 3% of our energy needs to be coming from class one by the renewable portfolio standard. By 2025, that's set to be dialed up to 15%. Utilities can either buy power from the actual generating facilities, or they can buy credits, renewable energy credits, to get that green star as opposed to actually buying the energy.
So a lot of numbers, Sam. So by 2025, 15% of New Hampshire's energy mix is supposed to come from wind. Is that right?
It's coming from class one sources, and that includes photovoltaic. That includes some of the more efficient biomass generation. So it's not necessarily just wind, but it is sort of these top of the line green energy providers.
Well, and so at the state level, you know, Governor Lynch signed on to this 25 by 25. In other words, 25% of our energy mix would be renewable by the year 2025. So that's at the top levels. But down at the local level, how's it going, Sam, when projects like this try to get off the ground?
Well, you know, as Ed mentioned, I think it sort of depends a lot in location by location. I think it mostly depends on how the locals see the land that they have purchased. If you see the land as a resource, as something from which you can be earning income. Ed talked about farmers a little bit. I've read accounts of folks who have wind turbines on their farmland, and they say they love the sound of them. To them, it's the sound of money. But if you've moved to a fairly mountainous or the lakes region because you like the views, you think it's beautiful to you, the land is something that's there to be looked at, to be admired. That's why you like the spot. It's very hard to accept these kinds of changes. So it really does, you know, depend location by location. We talked about Lempster, the wind farm that Iberdrola has already got up and running, the first one in the state. It's a much more working class area. You can imagine, compared to vacationers on Newfound Lake, that there would be more acceptance there than the proposed farms.
Well, and it's interesting. Yeah, you said people see wind as a extension of their use of the land in areas like Newfound Lake. Use of the land may mean attracting, well, it does mean attracting tourists. So it's a little bit of a different use there.
And there have been a lot of studies in other places where wind turbines have gone up looking at the impact on tourism. Nothing's really clear yet, though. The wind power is too new. People's conception of wind is too sort of vague at this point. And there has been no real strong correlation with the construction of wind farms and drop in tourism. However, like I said, there are too few projects to really produce statistically sound results in a study so far.
Well, and Lisa, we've talked before, and you've been a strong opponent of wind power. Do you oppose wind power overall, Lisa, in general, or are there certain types of wind projects that you see as better than others?
I appreciate the question. I'm not an opponent of wind energy, although I'm typically characterized that way. I'm a realist about wind energy, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that. You know, there are significant impacts associated with it. You cannot site a structure that stands 400 to 500 feet tall on a ridgeline and expect it to not have an impact. These create noise. They are the flicker effect from it when the sun is behind it. There is the visual impact that is quite dominating in areas that are where they're simply out of scale. So there are, and then we are still in the same way Sam was talking about tourism, the impacts on tourism and some of the other effects. We don't entirely understand the impacts of these projects, and we're still coming to understand even what the effect of the Coos County project will be, which was a significant impact environmentally. But on the realism side as well, people need to understand that this is one of the most expensive sources of generation on a wholesale basis. It is a source of generation that is not capable of being economically viable on its own. It needs significant amount of public dollars to make it functional and operate. And on top of that, it's a low-value resource. Wind energy produces at the time of day and time of year when we least need it. So here we are throwing billions of dollars into wind energy in the country, millions of dollars here in New England, and yet we're getting a very low return.
And I definitely want to ask Ed to follow up with some of those critiques. But Lisa, just a quick question for you. You mentioned wind power, you said, is not economically viable without significant subsidies. Aren't all alternative energies at this point in time anyway in that same boat, whether you're looking at solar or biomass or any of these other, you know, wind, tide power or something? Aren't all alternatives kind of in this phase where it's hard for them to get off the ground without subsidy?
Yes, but there's one big difference between wind, biomass, and solar. Wind energy largely produces at a time of day and time of year when we least need it. Solar, we could at least reliably expect it to operate when we need it. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a hot August day, solar is going to deliver for us, and we can pretty much predict when solar is going to come. We can't predict wind. Biomass, you're right, biomass does need subsidies, but it is a baseload source of generation. If we're talking about wanting to back out permanently fossil generation, biomass will get us there. Wind will not. Wind will displace some fossil use. It will not permanently back out fossil use.
Although biomass has its own concerns, as we've covered on this show, you know, creating more air pollution and so forth. Ed, real quick to you, lots of critiques, but let's start with the economic one that Lisa says. And mentioning storage, what is the storage issue surrounding wind energy that comes on at night when it's windiest, and that's the time when, you know, most of us are asleep when we're not using electricity?
Actually, wind farms, particularly in New Hampshire, operate just about during the day and night.
24/7.
It's not limited to the night at all. During the winter, they may produce more at night, but it's by no means limited to nighttime. Anyone that's come up to the Leominster Project, and we had some bus tours, saw the turbines operating at pretty high capacity. So that is a misnomer. The reason why those projects are there and that they are viable is because there are high wind resources, which means they can operate most of the year every day.
So you wouldn't put a project in a place where it just wasn't that windy, if not 24/7, many hours of the day.
Right. Of course not. And I want to get to another point that Lisa made, is that about federal subsidies. There are subsidies of every energy source, and wind is one of those. So it's a question of, what are the policies designed to encourage more development of fossil fuels or renewables?
All right. And we'll talk more about that after a short break, and a lot more of the issues that you brought up, Lisa. We'll start taking your calls, too. Our number here on the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning, and more on the wind power debate on the Exchange. And at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, privacy rights and government access to electronic messages. You can keep in touch with NHPR wherever you go with our iPhone app. You can stream us 24/7, download all of our podcasts, and receive news updates throughout the day. Always trying to make it easier for you to stay connected. Download the NHPR app for free at Apple's App Store. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the NEEF Network Organizations, a statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college. Information at nhheaf.org. From Water Street Bookstore in Exeter, hosting Kevin Phillips, author of 1775, A Good Year for Revolution, Monday, December 3rd at 7 p.m. Information at waterstreetbooks.com. And North Branch Construction, 54 years experience building custom homes to multi-million dollar eco-friendly commercial buildings on time, on budget, online at northbranch.net. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're re-examining the wind power debate in the Granite State in light of a new proposal for a major wind farm in the Newfound Lake area. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Should New Hampshire add more wind power? Is it a good move for our state or not? Is this a type of renewable energy that is the right fit for New Hampshire? Or would some other alternative in your mind be better? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. And all of you, before we go to the phones, I did want to just finish up this conversation we were having about the economic viability of wind energy. Lisa mentioned the subsidies, and we've been talking about whether you can, whether wind is produced during times of the day when you don't need it as much. Lisa, real quick to you, and then I want to bring Sam in. Ed's saying, hey, the wind resources that we're tapping are running pretty much 24 hours a day.
And that's simply not true. If you looked at the numbers from the ISO New England, which manages the grid, at the end of 2011, 396 megawatts of wind were installed. Of that, the ISO New England stated 39 megawatts were considered reliable generation, that is, arrived at the time of day and year when we need it. So I don't know where Mr. Cherian's getting his numbers, but the fact is 1.1% of that generation is actually arriving when we need it.
Can you store wind energy, Ed? Let's say if it were running, you know, great guns at midnight when people don't really need it, could you store it in a big battery somewhere or something?
There are some storage concepts, but there is really no viable energy storage concept for any type of generation, nuclear, coal, or otherwise, besides maybe a hydro pump storage type of facility. So the power grid operates such that the demand and the load and the production has to be balanced constantly. So if there's a drop in demand, then production has to be dropped by dropping power lines off or asking power plants to produce less.
You know, Sam, I want to ask you a question, too, but go ahead. I know you want to jump in here.
I just want to say I don't think anyone's proposing that wind is going to completely supplant our energy needs. But it has been estimated in the Department of Energy says that it can provide up to 20% of the electricity generated before it starts to have, reliability impacts and questions there. So it that is a little bit of a misleading argument, I think, and it's one that yes, you know, wind is unpredictable, but it's such a small chunk of the overall mix that other power plants can be brought online or as needed to deal with that.
And, you know, you're the environment reporter here at NHPR, as I said, Sam, and, you know, some people think of wind as a green, environmentally friendly alternative, and yet when there are projects proposed, people mention environmental impacts, and they don't mean good ones. What's the balancing act here?
You know, they do have impacts. I think that even Ed will admit to this. They have to fill wetlands. They have to take down trees. I would say, you know, I don't think there's been a really good study of this that I know of that I've seen. But in terms of land use per kilowatt generated, wind actually does pretty well compared to some of the other renewable energy sources. If you talk about biomass, if you talk about large scale hydro projects, all of those have immense impacts on land. Whereas with wind projects, you know, they'll have 6,000 acres that are being leased out for a project, but it's really only 1% of that land that's being impacted. So, you know, they do have impacts. Those are real, and they should be considered and talked about as how to minimize them. But I think that in the grand scheme of things, as a way to generate electricity, the land impact's pretty low.
Let's take some calls, all of you. Lots of people who want to join us. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. First up is John in Bridgewater. Hi, John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. I have a few concerns about the wind power. Only half of the problem of the eyesore of the windmills is the windmill themselves. It's the telephone transmission lines that come down through, and they shove them up some poor town's situation, like on Tenney Mountain, I point out. They put these giant poles all the way down. They make it a horrible eyesore, and they don't care. They never even asked the town whether or not it's okay to do it, and which that resulted in a lawsuit, and then he lost the case. And the second thing I'd like to say is the area under the mills, the windmills, is no man's land. Thousands of acres that you cannot go in anymore. They generally clear all the trees out from under the windmills. And that is a no man's land due to the fact that in the winter ice chunks come off the blades, so they don't want to take the liability, face the liability of having someone getting hit by them. And they also, once in a blue moon, I don't know how often this, I'm not up on the facts, but they do burn. They do short out, a bearing will go or something, and it causes a fire.
John, can I ask you a quick question? Yeah. Since you don't like wind, what other alternative energies do you like? What would you supplant wind with, given that, you know, the stated goal is to get off of fossil fuels, right?
Yes. I really support solar, an individual solar system on your house. If you want to cut down the coal use and fossil fuel use, set up a personal solar system in your house which you can do pretty reasonably. Everybody could do it for $2,000 or $3,000.
Okay, and John, I'm going to let you go just because we've got lots of people who want to jump in with us. I guess I'll go to you real quickly, Ed. Not only the eyesore, but the transmission lines. And he's concerned that there's a big chunk of what he called a no man's land under the turbines, that you're just taking too much land out of commission there for folks.
Well, the clearing around most turbines is about 500 feet diameter. It's not a significant clearing at all. And at our projects, both in Leominster and Groton, there are snowmobile trails that go through the area. There's hunting that occurs. There's agriculture. There's other recreation. So it is in no means a no man's land. You'll see at Leominster cows, you know, grazing underneath the turbines. The land is used for a number of other purposes, the same as it was before there was a wind farm there.
Lisa, real quick, and then back to our callers.
The concept of dual use with regard to these turbines is simply absolutely wrong. It is not easy to use the land around the turbines, and farmers in Illinois will tell you that. But if 2 points. One is, take the area of a circle that has a 500-foot radius and decide how big that is. That's quite a large area that's impacted. But also, to what Sam was saying, these are linear cuts. When we talk about the Coos County project, it's 33 miles of linear road built across the tops of four mountains. That's the kind of impact. We're not talking about something that's concentrated in one area. It is an enormous area that is linearly cut through, and that can't be this type of environmental or habitat impact there cannot be denied. And that's what you get when you get ridgeline development.
You know, I'm just putting myself in the shoes of the average listener right now, and I'm hearing Ed say one thing, I'm hearing you say another thing, Lisa, and everybody's got their own opinions and views. How are folks supposed to figure this out? How am I, if I'm really interested, maybe I'll ask you, Sam, how am I supposed to figure out what the real story is here? Sam?
I think, Laura, that from my experience, that the reality really lies somewhere in between what both Ed and Lisa are saying. You know, Ed says that the size of the clearing really isn't that large. Lisa says these are, you know, the impact is huge. It is true, you know, that it's a lot of clearing. It's a lot of land that's taken up, but it's impacted in a way it's not like, you know, this isn't Interstate 93 going over the top. You know, they're dirt roads. People talk about they're worried about wildlife corridors. You know, deer can cross these. It's not like there's traffic on them. So yes, there's a lot of impact. I think it is smaller than the opposition groups would like people to think, though.
Let's go to another call. This is David in Bridgewater. Hi, David. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I think the last point that Sam just made is an excellent one, which is that this is all energy generation has some impact. And I think this is a balanced approach. I live in Bridgewater. I am in favor of the project from what I've read. It is a balanced approach to our energy needs. I currently, you know, I live on Newfound Lake, and I currently look across at three of the wind turbines for the Groton project that's already been completed. And I personally have no problem with it. I look upon it as a moving art.
David, thanks a lot for the call. And Lisa, to you, he's sort of raising this, and I also asked another caller this. All energies have some sort of impact. Fossil fuels, as you know, are linked to air pollution and climate change. So if not wind, and I'm not saying that that's the answer to all our energy prayers, but, you know, a lot of people say it should be part of the mix. If not wind, what else? I mean, you don't want coal, right?
Well, the reality is, as long as we're expecting our electricity needs to be met when we need it, we're going to be living with the traditional sources of generation for the rest of my life and probably the rest of our children's lives until something else comes up. Renewable energy, and wind in particular, is not the source that's going to back out generation. To Sam's point when he was talking about DOE, Department of Energy report on 20% wind power by 2030, I want to be very clear. DOE states in that document that wind is not expected to be a capacity resource, meaning it is not expected to be there when we need it. The reason wind is being built in any generation, in any amount, according to Department of Energy, is to reduce our carbon emissions. It's being expected to displace fossil fuel, not replace it. So let's be realistic about that. So when you do generate at night when we least need it, yes, it will back out some natural gas. But during the day, it's not doing anything for us.
Wait, Ed said it is working during the day.
Okay.
Maybe not
a very small
high
percentage
capacity,
of it.
But
when it does arrive, it arrives. When it doesn't arrive, it's not. We're not relying on it to be there when we need it. And in fact, the ISO New England did its study, the New England Wind Integration Study, and I recommend everyone look at this. They state that if we are to get to 20% wind power, according to our RPS obligations for the five states that mandate it, we have to build 9,000 megawatts of wind, which because they were looking at wind in particular. But in addition, we have to keep all of our entire fleet of power plants operating today, and those that are proposed fossil fuel to be built. So we're talking about two generation sources of generation.
Okay, and I know you want to jump in, Ed, and you want to jump in, Sam, but I want to bring another voice into our conversation now. Joining us on the phone is Christoph Korshain, staff attorney for the Conservation Law Foundation in New Hampshire. And Christoph, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Well,
great to be here.
We've been trying to figure out just how to assess wind, whether it's the right fit for our state. Project by project, Christoph, how does your group, you're one of the major environmental groups in the state, how does your group assess these projects from an environmental standpoint?
Oh, it's a great question, Laura. And, you know, from the starting point, yes, we're a New England-wide environmental organization. One of our major programs is a clean energy and climate change program where we're really fighting for a clean energy economy for the region and the country, in part because we have really an existential crisis on our hands with climate change. And our approach is really to rely on good information, solid science, and approach both the whole problem and individual projects with the benefit of that information. And so we've looked at wind power as likely to play a substantial role in this clean energy economy we're talking about. Going to what Sam said about impacts and his assessment of that, we agree that there are these impacts. And so when you look at an individual project, it's really important to have that good information and to have a really sound regulatory process around a given project, so that it really isn't about developers pit against opponents in a very adversarial process. It's about it community engagement and really bringing out the information that the community needs to make informed decisions
types of
energy projects.
And the process, you know, even though it sounds a little insiderish, the process is important, right, Christoph? Because that has to do with what the ultimate shape of these projects are, some of the mitigation that needs to take place, how much community input there is. How weak or robust would you say, Christoph, the process by which these projects are approved is here in New Hampshire?
So I think there's a few interesting elements of the regulatory process in New Hampshire that bear discussion. Ed is right. It is a long process for developers to go through that is longer than in other parts of the country. It is fairly cumbersome. If you go onto the Site Evaluation Committee website, which is the siting board for the state of New Hampshire, and you look at the voluminous filings for each wind project, the amount of testimony and back and forth, it is extremely lengthy and cumbersome. And I think most people who've participated in it feel that it may be overly formal and difficult for ordinary community residents to participate in. And so one thing that, you know, so on that side of it, it is cumbersome. On the other side, I think we have a problem with that process in that it doesn't really do the balancing that you've mentioned and we agree needs to happen.
The balancing of local concerns versus that broader clean energy future, Christoph, is that what you're saying?
Yes, and providing some legitimacy and assurance to the public that each project that comes down the line will provide meaningful public benefits both locally and in terms of these clean energy outcomes that we're looking for.
All right, Christoph. Well, we'll talk with our guests in studio about the issues that you raise. I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Laura. It was great to be here.
Christoph Korshain, staff attorney for the Conservation Law Foundation in New Hampshire. Again, our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Ed, I'll go to you. What do you think the process by which these projects are approved here in New Hampshire? Lengthy and cumbersome? Too easy? Too hard? What do you think?
it's certainly very lengthy and cumbersome. Having been through it twice, it's more time with attorneys than I'm generally comfortable with. And the state generally takes a year, in some cases more, to exhaustively evaluate projects. And it's generally been generous about allowing interveners in, others to participate in the process. It is
interveners meaning community opponents?
Anyone. Doesn't even have to be local or abutters. And that makes for a longer process, but the SEC has traditionally had a very open arms in that regard of kind of letting everybody in and allowing any issue to be raised, whether it has substantiation to it or not. Compared to other states, it is very long and very expensive. Hopefully that means that what it results in is that the state and the various agencies that make up the SEC are able to look at every potential issue and review it and evaluate it before they reach a decision. So that is maybe the positive part of it.
SEC is a site evaluation committee. That's a state committee made up of sort of high-level officials, right, Sam, who evaluate these energy projects.
Yes, it's it's composed of various people who are appointed by various folks. So it's very insider baseball. It's a long involved process. And what's clear is that local communities really don't like that this decision has been taken out of their hands. I know in Antrim they tried to pass a local wind ordinance that essentially would have prohibited the creation of wind farms in their community in 2011. It did fail. So that process is going through the SEC as we speak. But when you go to the town meetings and the folks there learn that essentially it's this board in Concord that's going to make the decision, it's not something that goes over well in a crowded room.
Sure, with local control and town meeting and that whole tradition here in New Hampshire. Lisa, your thoughts?
I just wanted to address the Site Evaluation Committee operates under RSA 162H. That law states statutorily they're bound to come to a decision within 240 days, so 8 months. 8 months is not a long time when you consider the volume of information that has to be considered, the pre-filed testimony and the like, and it is an adversarial process, much like you would have with a trial. It's intimidating and difficult for individuals in their communities, and that is very hard. But at the same time, it's not overly onerous compared to Vermont, New York State, Washington State, Maryland, Virginia. States all over the country have the same process. So don't be fooled into thinking that New Hampshire is onerous and difficult and it should be, and we should limit the process. It is good for now, but I think there's definitely room for improvement.
All right. Well, after a short break, as many of your calls, emails, Facebook comments as we can squeeze in, you can still join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, and we'll hear from you coming up.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Cole Gardens Full Service Floral Shop, adding color to the holidays with floral arrangements, fresh flowers, and centerpieces shipped anywhere. Cole Gardens, Loudoun Road in Concord. And from New Hampshire Catholic Charities, transforming lives with vital programs that empower, assist, and heal. More information online at nh-cc.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
I'm Lisa Mullins. PRI's The World brings you more than just the day's news.
Well, the poor old British pub has been around for 2,000 years.
We introduce you to people around the globe.
I'm a Liberian, but I'm part of Africa.
If we were only in Argentina.
I think it's a Scottish thing, you know? This sense of doom there, but it's always kind of amusing to us.
Join us and hear The World. Weeknights at 7 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're delving into New Hampshire's wind power debate in light of a major new project proposed for the Newfound Lake area. Join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Send your email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page or on The Exchange page at nhpr.org. And Sam Evans-Brown, Lisa Lanoz, Ed Cherian, let's go right back to our listeners and go next to Noreen. Noreen is calling us from the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. Hi, Noreen. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
Good.
Good. I'm calling from the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. We are, and hi, Lisa, we haven't met yet, but we've exchanged a lot of emails, so thank you for your help.
Hi, Noreen.
We have an out-of-state company, actually a company from New Hampshire, who are prospecting up here in the Northeast Kingdom.
And yeah, I read about that in the paper, yeah.
Yeah, so what their goal is to put somewhere between 35 and 40 industrial wind turbines in the most remote area of Vermont. So, and the irony here is that my little sister has a house in Newfound Lake, and she's been listening to me rant and rave about my concerns about the destruction of the Northeast Kingdom, and she's now getting on board because she understands that the same thing's about to happen in her community. So here's what I know. What I know is that from the research I've done, from the work I've done, from what I can tell, the industrial wind turbines that are being put up really aren't a lot about energy generation. They're much more about profit. They're much more about creating, they're basically keeping the same energy paradigm that's going on right now, which means that large industrial corporations and utility companies end up keeping the profit, and rather than money going to local communities and rather than local communities being able to generate their own energy, this is a way of kind of keeping the control of energy generation in the hands of large corporations.
So, Noreen, would wind power be better if it were more micro instead of macro? Is that what you're getting at there?
Well, I think there are other solutions. The solutions are distributed energy instead of utility-scale energy. It's the solutions are communities producing their own energy. It's people taking ownership for their own production. It's like sustainable gardening. It's people taking ownership for their own production.
And Noreen, I'm going to let you go, because we have a million callers who want to join us. But I like your point, and it's one that I wanted to ask you about, Ed Cherry. And she and others have mentioned this word industrial wind. Is part of the problem, Ed, that these things are just so darn big and the companies behind them are just really big? Would your company or others be interested in looking at smaller scale? You know, we've heard about people putting little teeny turbines up on the roofs of their buildings, for example. I mean, is that part of the problem because they're just so big?
Well, we work on projects of all different sizes, and some of them are community-owned land, farmers' cooperative land, where farmers get together and create a consortium of landowners and come to us or another developer. So there's all sorts of different models. As far as smaller turbines, they're just not very efficient to generate larger amounts of power. And I don't disagree with Noreen that distributed energy and community-based power is part of the solution, but you still need larger sources of power to run factories and run cities. Someone that lives in a city in an apartment, you know, can't have their own solar panels. A factory has to have a dedicated source of power. So there's need for a larger power grid and larger sources of power, regardless of how much community-type development you do.
Thanks for the call, Noreen. And again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Sean's calling from Grafton. Hi, Sean. You're on the air. Go ahead.
How are you doing today?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. A couple things. My goal is to help educate the public so that they can make a responsible, informed decision. Real quick, in regards to the land use, the land that's currently leased by Iberdrola and Grafton is all posted. Beyond that, I just wanted to put that out there.
Posted meaning you can't do what on it, Sean?
It's not permitted to be used without any owner permission on the signs.
Yeah, so you're not even supposed to walk there, you're saying?
Correct.
Okay. Sometimes it's posted just against snowmobiles or against hunting or, you know, so.
Correct. My question really has to do with the without this ability to store the energy produced, current energy producing plants, biomass, coal, etc., cannot be taken offline and keep up with a consistent demand. In turn, the pollutants deemed to be reduced by this green energy actually are not reduced at all. The chemical components, however, are increased because the plants have to fluctuate their production in order to take on the energy produced by the wind turbines. This was taken from a third-party research that was completed for the state of Colorado from www.bentechenergy.com.
Okay, so getting back to the storage problem, but I believe, Ed, you said earlier that isn't as much of a problem as has been stated.
Well, the power grid is constantly adjusted minute by minute, even second by second, as demand changes. So, and there's a curve, there's a daily curve, and there's a seasonal curve, or the amount of power that's used during the day, during the night, summer and winter. Because it's a constant system that has to be balanced, the production has to be adjusted as well. So power plants are continually adjusted. You have peaker plants that are typically oil or gas that are brought online in periods of greater demand. And when there's slack demand, power projects are curtailed, including wind projects sometimes.
Sean, thanks for raising the issue. Lisa, we talked about this before, but go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that the demand for electricity in New England, particularly since 2008, has been flat and dropping. And ISO New England is stating now that projecting out to 2022, it is going to stay very flat. So the need for more capacity to be built in New England is not there. And building wind is not, as I said, is not meeting our capacity needs. But in any event, we don't need any more power plants to be built in New England.
Here's an email from Sarah who says, we need more green energy. We can do this safely and effectively using many different sources. The sun, the wind, the water. Many skeptics of alternative power will say wind is not efficient and costly to maintain. Sarah says, I say compared to what? We need to look at our current power sources and say we can do better than this. Oil is expensive, messy, burning it is unhealthy for our air, our water, our ecosystems. We can't even eat fish too often found from our lakes due to mercury. There is much opposition to green energy due to the oil lobby and that many of our government officials are bought and paid by these guys. End the conflicts of interest in our government, and we can be freer to choose the energy that best fits our present day. Sarah commented on the Exchange's Facebook page. She says, open up markets, create jobs. Lisa, this is something that we've returned to a couple times already this hour. Okay, so if you don't like wind, what? What else? Everything has a cost. Nothing's perfect.
Everything has a cost, and we, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to need generation that's going to meet our demand. But the bottom line with regard to wind, when you talk about how expensive it is, Mr. Tarian's Groton project right now is selling wholesale into Massachusetts, by the way, not here in New Hampshire. It's somewhere in the range of 9.2 to 9.4 cents a kilowatt hour wholesale. That's double the average price of wholesale electricity in New England. We're paying a tremendous amount for that, and the cost over its 20-year period or 15-year period for its contract is going to be millions of dollars above market cost. That's what we're paying for an electricity source that we can't reliably expect to show up when we need it. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about wind.
Some say, though, Lisa, we're paying now with fossil fuels. You know, we have people who have asthma, we've got climate change, we've got air pollution, we've got mercury in our lakes, as the person who commented on our Facebook page. So, you know, there's cost per kilowatt hour, but there are other costs
as
well.
That's right. You're exactly right. And if you look at New England's energy profile, at least in terms of our clean energy profile, we are cleaner now than we've ever been before. We've already met our RGGI caps, which were set to be met in 2018. We're well below that now, and we're progressive. There was testimony yesterday on the Antrim Wind Project before the Site Evaluation Committee that made clear that we are on a downward scale in terms of our cleaning. Our emissions are dropping.
I think that's due to the economy, though, isn't it?
It's due to the economy. It's due to natural gas prices being low. It's due to demand going down. It's due to a lot of reasons, and it's not because we're building wind. We are getting cleaner without building wind.
Natural gas prices. I'm glad you mentioned that, Lisa, because that's been a factor, Sam. Also, the controversy over Solyndra, the subsidized solar power company that the Obama administration subsidized. I've read a couple articles lately that say, given the Solyndra controversy, given the incredibly low price of natural gas, that there's less interest these days in so-called green power. What do you think?
Well, you know, that's certainly true, and I think that especially given the controversies that have popped up around each of these projects, that continues to be the case that it's hard to push these through. I would like to say that when we talk about the need to increase demand or increase the generation because of need to meet future demand, there's a lot of environmentalists who will say that this money could be better spent on efficiency. I know that the president of Sierra Club Canada has said, if you give me $1 billion subsidies, I'll produce more megawatts than any generation project if I spend it on efficiency projects. So there, you know, that is probably the least controversial way to reduce demand. However, it's not very sexy. People don't like to talk about winterizing their house. It's pretty tough to sell.
And real quick, and then back to our callers.
Just a quick response to Ms. Leno's. NSTAR is the purchaser of the power from Groton. NSTAR is part of Northeast Utilities, the parent company of PSNH. And one of the benefits of wind power, even though it is more costly than natural gas, particularly now, is it provides a hedge against price volatility. Gas prices are low now. You go back a few years, gas prices spiked. With a wind power contract or others, you have a hedge against that volatility, and that's why utilities are interested in them. It provides some price guarantee.
Let's go back to our callers. Try and squeeze one more in if we could. Michael's waiting in Georges Mills. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm a global energy and climate policy consultant. I spent 30 years developing fossil-fired power plants in different parts of the world, and now advise governments and companies and regulators on how to decarbonize the power sector. And I just want to comment on some of the things that Lisa and Ed have said. You know, Lisa is the type of disingenuous opponent that I encounter in various parts of the world who leads by saying that she's not opposed to wind power and then very clearly is just adamantly opposed to wind power. And on the basis of repeating a number of dangerous myths that are perpetuated by opponents of renewables, I want to point her to a number of extremely robust and multi-stakeholder studies, including one that we sponsored in Europe that is now one of the driving forces behind European energy policy that involved almost every large utility in Europe as well as large manufacturers like Siemens and GE.
Michael, we're nearing the end of the hour, right. So I did want to ask you to wrap up if you could, please.
Right, I'll make my point, which is that there are numerous ways to demonstrate that 60 to 80% of the electricity could be provided from a mix of renewable resources based on the technology that we have today economically. Ed missed an opportunity to talk about energy storage opportunities that exist today, distributed energy storage using what's referred to as end-use thermal energy storage, very simple things like taking electric water heaters, commercial chilling facilities, refrigeration units in grocery stores, and using smart technology to allow them to shift.
The smart grid, yeah. Michael, if I could ask you a quick question, because you've been involved in the energy industry for a long time. You said you started out in fossil fuels. Now you're working on alternatives. It seems so obvious to you that, you know, we should move in this direction. But boy, these projects in New Hampshire, this latest project in Vermont, I read about a project that's engendering intense opposition. We heard from one of our callers. I even read that in Britain, people are getting frustrated with some of the impacts of wind power. So, you know, you like it, but a lot of people are upset about it. And I wonder why you think that's the case.
Well, you know, the point's been made already, but, you know, we have to face up to the fact that these, like all power plants, are industrial facilities. And yes, people that are close to them would rather not be. But so are people that live close to coal-fired power plants that all of us rely on. You have to sort of come to grips with the scale of the problem. I mean, we have a massive industrial economy that relies on reliable electricity, as Lisa has pointed out. There are ways to do that with clean energy, but there's a role for distributed community-based energy. Unfortunately, for people who don't like it, there's also an indispensable role for large centralized sources of energy, and our modern industrial economy requires both.
Okay, Michael, thanks for calling in. Is the bottom line, what do you think, Sam, that people just don't like change?
Well, you know, I it's tough to characterize what people do or don't want.
Right, because clearly there's two sides of this issue. Right. But it does seem like part of the problem is, and Lisa, I want to hear from you too, is just adjusting to this. It's different.
It is very different, and I think that part of the problem is that people come to New Hampshire for a certain reason. So when we talk about why is it tough to sell wind in New Hampshire, the people who live here tend to move here because of the natural beauty that they see, and that's why they've come here. It's tough to sell that to them.
And Lisa, the caller called you disingenuous, and I did want to give you an opportunity to respond to that. You did start by saying, no, I'm not opposed to all wind, but I have serious questions. Is there any type of wind power that you would support?
Well, let me just say, I didn't hear anything that he stated that I would disagree with. He unfortunately didn't have a time to go into any of the options, but the the bottom line with wind, and I'll take the same position that anyone else will take, if it can be properly cited and shown that it's not going to, that its benefits are going to outweigh its detriments, then I can't have any issue with it. And that's, it's as clear as that. And I don't think any of the projects in New England have demonstrated that, or at least in New Hampshire have demonstrated that.
And Ed, we started off talking about this again, proposal by Iberdrola to build a pretty big project up in the Newfound Lake area. What's the next step in this process regarding the project called Wild Meadows?
Well, we've had a series of meetings with the Board of Selectmen in three towns, and we've had a series of open houses. And the next step is we'll have a number of different question and answer sessions run by the Selectmen or at their behest.
And you did some public meetings just recently.
We've done a number of public meetings. And there's a number of other public meetings that are not in the media, meetings with groups of neighbors and houses, community groups and others, loggers groups that are ongoing. And it's a long process. I have a chart I showed once of the timeline for Groton. And from the time of the first meteorological test tower to collect wind, which was 2006, until now when the project's just being finished, that's 6 years. It's a long process of education and, frankly, debate, because there are competing interests. There are those that come to New Hampshire and don't want any change, but there's also a lot of working loggers and farmers that need to be able to pay their taxes as well.
All right. Well, all of you, we'll probably be talking about this again, I think. I want to thank everybody very much for coming in today. Lisa Linnoes, good to see you. Thank you for making the time.
Thanks, Laura.
Lisa Linnoes, Executive Director of Industrial Wind Action. Ed Cherian, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Ed Cherian, Regional Development Director for Iberdrola Renewables, a Spanish-owned company that's the second largest wind operator in the U.S. And Sam Evans-Brown, thank you also for taking some time out of your day.
Thanks, Laura.
Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter who's been following this wind story. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.